Good morning, everybody. I'm Karen Von Hippel, the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS, along with this gentleman in the front row, Rick Barton. On behalf of Dr. John Hamry, the president of CSIS, I'd like to welcome you all here today to what we hope will be a very rich discussion about the presidential and provincial council elections in Afghanistan, which, of course, as we all know, are still inconclusive. The latest figures we saw today are 60.3% of polling stations have reported, 47.3% for Karzai, 32.6% for Dr. Abdullah, and 11.6% for Bashar Dost, the third leading candidate. What we'd like to do today is, it's certainly my pleasure to introduce this very distinguished panel, and what I'd like to do is make a brief introductory remark about each of them. You all have their bios. We don't have a lot of time, so I'd encourage you to read their bios if you want more information about them. Each speaker will speak for 5 minutes, and then we will open the floor for discussion. We have, in addition to some of the cameras you see in the back of the room, CSIS TV will also be recording this event, so you can encourage your friends to download it on iTunes University or watch it again if you missed some fantastic points. So our first speaker will be Ken Wallach, who is, as everyone here knows, a president of the National Democratic Institute. He and his institute have observed more than 200 elections. They have vast experience in this area. He will talk about the really extraordinary challenges of trying to organize elections in a very complex conflict environment that we have today in Afghanistan. He'll be followed by Dr. Christine Fair, who's a professor at Georgetown. She was out as a long-term observer working on the security. She was doing a security analysis for the elections, and she'll talk about that. She has to leave a little bit early, so she's not upset or offended if you see her slink off on the side. Then we'll have Peter Manikas, who's the regional director for Asia programs at NDI, and he's going to get into more of the nitty-gritty and more of the analysis about the election results and what may happen. he'll be followed by – he's also going to compare with the 2004-05 elections. And then Kristen Haffert runs the women's programs at NDI, and she was out in Afghanistan for about 5 weeks monitoring women's participation in the lead-up to the elections. She's going to talk about the role of women and the problems women had in participating in the elections. And then finally, last but not least, Ambassador Carl Inderfirth is going to, who was one of the observers, part of the observer team, he'll provide some analysis from his perspective. So without further ado, over to you, Ken.
Thank you very, very much, Karen. Karen has mentioned that NDI has observed some 200 elections around the world, and I have to say at the outset that this was by far the most challenging observation mission that we have ever carried out, and I think I can say on behalf of the other observer delegations that were there, it was perhaps the most challenging for them as well. And we shouldn't. We should also not overlook the fact that there was a strong Afghan domestic election observation known by its acronym FIFA that trained and deployed more than 7,000 Afghan observers that did an extraordinary job. And we were very proud to have supported FIFA not only during this election but during its inception prior to the 2004 and 2005 elections. And we relied very much on the relationship that we have developed over the years with FIFA. In addition to the people on this panel who were in the country, we also benefited measurably by a leadership group that included former Senator Gary Hart, John Manley, the former Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Canada, who headed the Manley Commission, that was sponsored by the Government of Canada 2 years ago, or a year ago, that looked into Canada's engagement in Afghanistan. And also Nora Owen, the former Justice Minister of Ireland. That leadership team also was informed by, as Karen said, 27 long-term observers who were in Afghanistan since July that were stationed in every region of the country. Also by individuals who were looking at functional areas. Christine, who was examining the Afghan security forces, Kristen Heffert, who was examining women's participation, and a third person who is still in Afghanistan now, who was looking at the election administration and the complaints process. Trying to deal with the security issue in Afghanistan was the most difficult challenge for our delegation and the other observer groups that were there. We tried to deal with this issue with some creativity. First, we tried to deploy in as many provinces as we could. We ended up being in 19 of the 34 provinces, which I think was more provinces than any of the other observer groups. We were able to do so because of a separate program NDI was engaged in, and that was training some 31,000 candidate agents at polling sites in the months leading up to the election. And that was a program that was supported by the UNDP. And the trainers for that program were a very talented group of Afghans who have been with the Institute for the past several years. They could go where internationals could not. They knew the election procedures and the laws better than anybody, and we benefited greatly from their reports, which were among the best that were coming in from very difficult areas. We made a strategic decision at the outset not to send internationals into provincial reconstruction teams. Others decided to do that. We would rather benefit from Afghan observers who were well-trained and knowledgeable, because we feared that we would be fighting to get into the PRTs, and then we would be fighting to try to get out of the PRTs on Election Day. And I think many of the other observers found out that once they were in the PRTs on Election Day, they were either denied an opportunity to leave or they could only see polling sites in the immediate vicinity of the PRTs. So I think it was a good decision. I think we were able to garner a lot of information on Election Day. But in the name of full disclosure, I would have to admit that we, like the Afghan voters, were hampered by the insecure environment in a number of parts of the country. And we have to admit it. We have to deal with that issue, that we could not go to certain provinces where we wanted to go, and we could not go to certain places within certain provinces that we would have wanted to go. Nevertheless, we received literally hundreds of reports, and some of those are reflected in the statement that you have that was released in Kabul, and they will be part of a larger final report. I think our statement reflected a measured assessment, our preliminary statement of the election. We talked about some of aspects of the election that were consistent with democratic principles, but at the same time, we talked about serious flaws in the process and, needless to say, the insecure environment in a number of parts of the country. As we look at this election now, and with all the problems that have emerged, some of them we witnessed directly, there are two, perhaps, silver linings. The first is a highly sophisticated software system that the Independent Election Commission possesses. And that software allows for certain votes coming from certain stations to be quarantined if there seems to be anomalies or evidence of fraud. And from our observers who are watching the count now, it seems as though that software system is working, and there are a number of results from stations that have been quarantined. What happens to those votes, we do not know as of yet. The second silver lining is the Electoral Complaints Commission itself. From all the elections that we observe around the world, this is a very unique institution. Perhaps it reflects the weakness of the judicial system in Afghanistan, but there are very few countries around the world that immediately after the election that you have a body that can investigate complaints quickly, can adjudicate those complaints, and has the authority to annul results. And they can do all this before the final results are certified. A lot of responsibility falls on the ECC, but I can tell you in most countries, the complaints go to the judiciary or to a special electoral tribunal, and sometimes it takes months, if not years, before complaints are resolved. In the case of Nigeria, before the last elections, they were annulling results in elections when people had been seated in office for 3 years already. So this is a unique process, and I think it gives us some hope that the problems that we have been reading about and the problems that we have observed will be dealt with, and we hope that's the case. Finally, I think there's two things I want to say. The first is that this was not simply a presidential election. This was 34 elections. One election dealt with the president, and 34 elections dealt with provincial councils. And so we have to look at this election in a much more, in a much broader way. The provincial councils in Afghanistan is the only subnational entity that interfaces with citizens. And if the provincial council fails to perform its role under very difficult and challenging conditions, that the Afghan people ultimately could very well lose faith in the entire governing structure of their country. And yet they face enormous challenges. On one hand, a highly centralized government that has been reluctant to devolve authority beyond the governors, provincial reconstruction teams that are dispensing a good deal of development funds, local warlords, and therefore, because of these conditions, you have provincial councils that don't have budget authority that begin to get marginalized because of all these conditions. And I believe that it behooves the international community. It's a little bit self-serving. NDI has been working with about 20 of the provincial councils from 7 offices around the country. But it behooves the international community to spend more time building up the capacity of these councils so they can fulfill their responsibilities in the country. And finally, let me make the point about the election. There are those before this election and there are those that now make the case that the best outcome in Afghanistan is for a first round declaration of a victor, and that perhaps a power-sharing agreement that could avoid the ethnic tensions that may emerge in the run-up to a second round. I would argue, however, that the most important goal for both the Afghan people and particularly those who courageously turned out at the polls and defied the violence and the threat of violence, and for the international community, is first the integrity of the process, wherever that leads us, and secondly, to the issue of legitimacy of the government that emerges from this election, both at the national and the local level. And I doubt whether the Afghan people would have gone into this election feeling that the best outcome would have been some behind-the-scenes deal between a handful of leaders to avoid a process that was to reflect the hopes and aspirations and the will of the people.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Ken. Over to you, Christine.
So as you heard, my task was to go around and meet with several of the other long-term observer teams. I went to Jalalabad. I met with our poor team in Kunduz, as well as Herat. And, of course, I spent time in Kabul. So my task was to try to understand how the security environment shaped the credibility of the multiple elections that Ken discussed. And I think in many places, security was an overdetermining factor in the sense that it sort of set a ceiling as to how credible some of those elections could be. Prior to the election itself, the security environment shaped the availability of updating the registration list. Some folks were simply unable to update the registration list. In some cases, folks were very able to register, because you could actually buy the registration cards in the open market. And you would have the peculiar outcome of having enormous numbers of women registered. And I'm not sure it's because the liberated ladies of Oruzgan were out there claiming their franchise. So even going into the election, the security environment shaped or put a limit in terms of how credible that exercise would eventually be. The security arrangements that were in place, the actual polling station itself, the first perimeter of security was the police, the outer perimeter was the ANA, and then in actual extremis, ISAF was supposed to be the provider of security. There were set up these things called operational coordination centers, both at the regional level, with the regional commands, but also at the provincial level. We had a chance to go to one of those in Kunduz, and to say that it was stood up at the last minute I think would be flattering for the organization that was in place. So the standing up of the OCCs were very uneven across the country, and some of them were literally constituted only the week before the election. And yet it's the OCCs that were supposed to be gathering information throughout the province and trying to come up with an appropriate security response. Interestingly enough, there was supposed to be in place a UNDP elect ran it. It was a police training program. It was a train-the-trainer program. In theory, the police were trained in this sort of cascading fashion, but the reality was that under the best assumptions, the police that were used on Election Day maybe got 3 hours or so of election training, and certainly one has to wonder what the outcomes were of that training, given that the police capacity in Afghanistan writ large is really leaves something to be desired. That, I think, is a larger concern about the Afghan elections, is that police are so important, yet police have really lagged behind the training of the Afghan National Army, which I think everyone would agree is a success. I think most people would say the Afghan National Police training has not been a success. So you would have areas such in Kunduz, where for a district you had maybe 50 police officers. And so it's not a surprise in those districts you had Taliban running roughshod, which seriously restricted the ability of people to actually turn out on election day. Another interesting thing that we stumbled across was that the Afghans had really delayed recruiting female security agents, the women that will pat you down before you go down to vote. And this should have been anticipated to be a problem, because outside of the capital, it's difficult to recruit women, period, for security jobs, even more so once you leave the capital. And in some cases, this task was left to about 2 weeks before Election Day. So that seemed to have been a fairly large but ultimately preventable oversight. Another interesting thing that we heard a lot about before the election, but it was definitely the dog that didn't bark, and that was what could be humorously called the Nurbakai. Some of you know about the so-called militias called Arbakai. President Karzai's brother-in-law, Nurzai, actually put together circa sometime in June or July a somewhat national militia plan that aimed to deploy between 10 and 13,000 militias. Conveniently, they were largely planned to be deployed mostly in the south. It was never clear what these guys were supposed to do. Would they be armed? Would they bring their own gun? How would they be uniformed? How would the police know that they're, legitimate militias and not illegitimate militias? No one that we've spoken to or that I've spoken to on Election Day saw a heavy presence of these militias. Reasons for this have ranged from a fellow colleague of mine down in Logar. He said, "Well, I just think the governor ran off with the money." So who knows why we didn't see those militias, but there was a lot of apprehension about them before Election Day. Now, about violence itself, before the election, as we all know, there was considerable violence targeting candidates, party workers, campaign managers. And while we don't have the complete universe of victims of violence or threats of violence, it does look as if women were more vulnerable. Candidates routinely complained that they had inadequate security. The Ministry of Interior told them that they could go out and hire their own folks, but they said they'd pay them. It wasn't clear how they would get paid, how they would be armed. So there was a fairly consistent concern among candidates. They were not getting the security that they needed. And obviously, leading into the election, voters themselves were intimidated. In Taliban-controlled areas, there are reports that the Talibs were taking advantage of the mosque to issue sermons, making it very clear that there'd be reprisals if they voted. We all heard about if your finger has the ink, we're going to cut your finger off. In Helmand, the threat escalation went up to your head being removed if you voted. But again, you know, there were certainly afterwards reports of this, but the Taliban really did not they did not honor their pledge to violence in the fullest. Another thing that came up quite often was that Afghans themselves were uncertain about the security arrangements that the government put into place. Now, Afghans were very conspiratorial about this. Their assessment was, well, it behooves the incumbent to basically have an environment of insecurity to discourage voter turnout, the logic being less voter turnout, greater opportunities for fraud. Whether or not that's true or not, that's just how it was interpreted. But going forward for future elections, the government might actually want to invest some effort trying to explain to the citizenry that this is the security preparations that are going to be here, therefore you should feel secure in casting your vote. There were a number of really interesting reports, and we saw some of this in the press yesterday, right, in the New York Times. There were all sorts of stories that Karzai had actually cut deals with Talib commanders, by which no one would cast a vote, so that would keep the Taliban happy, but the Taliban also would not stop ballot boxes being returned, full of votes. And I think some of you saw the press reporting yesterday that in Kandahar there was 23,947 votes returned for Karzai when, in fact, no one had the opportunity to cast a vote. So I think that perhaps another area that might merit thinking about is that we've sort of thought about security as shaping the electoral exercise, but many people actually said security was actually used as an excuse to disenfranchise some voters. We heard quite a number of concerns that areas were deemed to be insecure because they were not areas that were expected to support the incumbent. There were considerable disagreements between the IEC and the security forces about which polling centers could be open. And in Kunduz, I mean, it wasn't clear what polling centers were going to be open until the absolute last minute. We know that because we had an LTO team up there. The problem with that is that in some cases they decided to co-locate polling centers. So if you actually looked at the polling centers that were open, you would have polling centers moved out from the outside of the district into the district center. So you could say, oh, yes, we had polling centers open in the district. The problem, of course, is Afghanistan has very poor logistics. The roads are really, not practicable. And so women in particular, if they had to move large distances to polling centers, it would be tantamount to being disenfranchised. So while at first blush it looks as if co-locating polling centers to a district center for security reasons might have some advantages, it did have the effect of making it impossible for many people to actually cast their vote. So, you know, moving forward, especially if there's a runoff, I think there are a number of things that really need to be thought out today, not the day before the runoff. And certainly if there is not a runoff, thinking about the next set of elections, namely the parliamentary elections. Police training has to remain a focus. The international community, as much as the Afghan government, is culpable for the lack of police on Election Day. We've known about these elections for some time, yet the police training billets still remain understaffed at 30%. To quote a U.S. government official last summer, that's great unless you actually want to win. So it's incomprehensible why police training has remained a low priority amongst the international community. And it's, you know, the Americans are paying the bills. We're largely doing the training. It would be great if some of our NATO ISAF partners would step up. That has to be a priority. And similarly, greater effort needs to be done to get female search agents. Whatever the security arrangements are in place, the government really needs to communicate that, because it makes no difference whether they have the best security arrangement in place if Afghans don't actually believe that they're going to be secure in casting their vote. And then finally, we really do need some accountability about what these militias were doing, if anything. As I said, we've had a lot of difficulty tracking down what the militias were actually up to. But I think the very fact that Karzai's brother-in-law put this plan into place and the way in which they were deployed looks somewhat dubious. There really needs to be an accounting of what those guys were up to. And going forward, when we look at the Norzai-Arbakai plan, the international community kind of signed off on it. And the logic sort of went like this: in the South, if people couldn't get out to register, couldn't get out to vote, then the credibility of the election would be in peril. I think the message needs to be from the international community that militias are actually no excuse for police. And so if you're going to go out of your way to try to have a reasonably competent militia force, you probably are better served taking those efforts and trying to get them into actual police training billets. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris. Okay, over to you, Peter, for some trends and comparison with 2004-2005.
Sure. Thank you very much, Karen. Well, the news reports, I think, that we're receiving every day now present an unrelentingly negative picture of what's going on in Afghanistan. In fact, I think it's reflected in our statement that our delegation found that the election was really difficult to characterize in a single phrase. Violence and fraud have clearly marred the electoral process and now threatens the legitimacy of any new government. But unfortunately, those reports overshadow some aspects of the election period, I think, that were pretty positive and an improvement over the elections in 2004 and 2005. Unlike the election campaigns of the past, these elections, in fact, involved issues. The candidates campaigned throughout the country. Abdullah was able to go to remote districts in the Pashtun South. Barshadost had a van traveling throughout the country communicating his populist message, and President Karzai, of course, could travel almost everywhere trying to make a deal, as did Abdullah, in fact. It was well covered by the news media. Our long-term observers were reporting that throughout the country, small groups of people were getting together, talking about the campaign, discussing the issues. Abdullah was communicating a message of more decentralization, a parliamentary as opposed to a presidential system. And they were talking about Karzai's record and his approach to governance. Political parties played a role in this campaign that they had not played in the past. There were about 10 or so parties that were able to field candidates in between 5 and 10 provinces for the provincial council races. For the first time, party names appeared on the ballot. That had never been the case in the past. It promises to help establish an effective party system that's been so far totally absent. There were more women participating in this campaign. There were more women candidates for provincial councils than there had ever been in the past. And millions of Afghans voted despite the threat of violence. All of those, I think, were important things that, in discussing the election, we don't want to entirely overlook. Unfortunately, there was really little that was done over the past 5 years to sort of improve the process and address a lot of the defects in the system that were very apparent back in 2004 and 2005. Perhaps foremost among them is the millions of duplicate and counterfeit registration cards that have just flooded the country. Months before the election, you could buy such a card for about $10. As the election approached, the price had inflated quite considerably. What people were doing with the cards, of course, was not entirely a mystery. They were being sold to people that wanted to commit some sort of electoral fraud. They're used in schemes both for ballot stuffing and for proxy voting. And they really threaten to sort of delegitimize the entire process if something's not done about it. Local election officials have not been well trained. They're quite well trained at the national level for the most part. The local level we saw in 2004 and 2005 that they were not capable of fully sort of understanding the process. They implemented the inking poorly back then, and we saw the same problems emerge at the local level now. And in addition to that, they're recruited locally, so they're subject to political pressures at the village level, which of course, leads into the proxy voting and ballot stuffing. The absence of a functioning judicial system really results in widespread immunity for anybody who engages in electoral misconduct. All these things had been out there. Everybody knew about them. Very little was done. I think about 5 or 6 months before the election, there was kind of a renewed effort to pour resources into the system and to fill all the observable gaps that people saw in electoral administration, but it was too late. You can't deal with problems of millions of voter registration cards in the system just a few months out. we have another election coming up in about, in October, I guess. If these problems aren't addressed now, they really threaten the entire legitimacy of the process. Then there's not much time. And what has to be done immediately is to reconstitute the Electoral Complaints Commission. It expires sort of automatically about 30 days or so after the certification of the results, and it has to be reestablished. They should do so immediately because the ECC really didn't have time to prepare for this current election. There's a lot of other things. They're just planning for security is something that really requires several months, and that was done very late in this process as well. As Karen mentioned, the results are still coming in. This process is not over. We're watching it play out day by day. 60% of the votes have been counted, as Karen said. A lot of the votes that haven't been counted are in the Pashtun South. There have been, those are presumably Karzai votes, but there's also fewer votes down there. So how that plays out in the end is kind of anybody's guess. The question, of course, is that if it's 51% for Mr. Karzai, is that going to be widely accepted in the Afghan population? Are there going to be suspicions that it's not a legitimate result? A lot of talk about a deal. When we were there, we were talking to both Afghans and people in the international community about brokering some sort of arrangement. All that's going to be playing out over the next several weeks. So that's where we are. The complaint process continues. As I mentioned, there are 2,000 complaints have been filed. 500 are considered serious. By serious, I mean can't affect the outcome of the election. So we wait, as you do, for the final tallies.
Great. Thank you very much. And now over to you, Kristen, to talk about women's role in the election.
Thanks, Karen. As Karen mentioned earlier, I was in Afghanistan for 5 weeks monitoring women's participation in the lead-up to the elections, and I had a very unique experience in that I was able to spend quite a bit of time speaking with many of the female provincial candidates during that time. And so what I thought I'd do today, some of the challenges that women had in the election have been mentioned already, security, proxy voting. What I thought would be interesting is if I sort of gave you a glimpse of what I heard from these candidates and give you a little bit more of a sense of what we heard on the ground from their perspective. Prior to the elections, NDI trained 226 of the 333 women who ran for provincial council. And for most of these women, it was the only training they'd ever had in their lives. And this was particularly important because for 122 of them, they'll automatically get seats on the provincial council due to the 25% quota. Of these 200 women, NDI selected 18 women from 9 of the provinces. And we interviewed those candidates 3 times, 2 times prior to the election and once after. And through these interviews, we were really able to sort of glean information that we weren't able to get even through our short-term observers and our long-term observers, partly because some of them were in provinces where we didn't have a presence due to security concerns. And so we were able to sort of track their experiences as candidates throughout the election, but also hear from them what they saw in female polling stations on election day. So, unsurprisingly, you've heard security was really the number one concern that all of them expressed. And Christine mentioned the co-location of polling sites, which really prevented many women from traveling to be able to vote. And while this was definitely true in the South and the Southeast, this was actually true once you really got out in many provinces out of the urban areas, or just out of the city. One woman said to us in Ghazni, "I rented a car with my personal money to take some women to the polling station, but they refused riding in my vehicle, and told me that they're not permitted by their families to get in those cars. And that's really what we heard. Although the 18 women that we interviewed all went out and cast their votes for themselves, they knew from friends and families that the male members of the family were not permitting women to go out and vote. And it was interesting because we saw on Election Day that women actually came out later in the day. Men were out, the lines were longer earlier, and then it looks like women sort of swelled in the afternoon, which may have actually been a result of the security concerns. Women also told us that, as Christine mentioned, the challenge of recruiting female staff was very high, and they saw women who were unprepared. It was sort of a mix. There were some women who were prepared and really following everything to a T, and other women who were uneducated, unprepared. And these candidates that we spoke with really had a concern that that would sort of create an enabling environment for fraud. One of the challenges, of course, was security and recruiting female staff, both to check IDs and as security guards, but also the lack of literacy, especially in the rural areas, was another major challenge that women cited to being able to recruit staff. As far as the voter IDing goes, we heard from many women that women in burqas would go to vote and actually weren't their faces weren't checked against their pictures on their voter card, and the photos on the voter cards were actually optional. So in many cases where there weren't photos, women still weren't asked to sort of give the name of their father and were just allowed to vote without any sort of screening. As we also heard a great deal from the women candidates that we spoke with about proxy voting, and we heard more about young females voting than we did actually male members of families going. We heard both, but we heard quite a number of instances where women, young women in burqas under the age of 18, went in and voted, and they had voter registration cards, so they were actually permitted to vote. So that speaks to really the flaws in the registration process. One woman said in Herat, she said, "I was informed by my brother, who was my agent in a mail polling station, that he had observed some cases of proxy voting. In a specific case, a man wanted to vote on behalf of his wife and daughters, reasoning that they were not allowed to get out of the house on election day. He was further arguing that this is his right to vote instead of his female family members." Women also requested that their fingers not be inked, and actually their requests were granted for fear of retribution from the Taliban. Just on the issue of female candidates in particular, we heard a number of instances really throughout the country, including in Kabul, of women being warned of a landmine on their way to a campaign event, night letters, anonymous phone calls. In fact, one woman gave us the number of the man in Pakistan who called to threaten her in case we wanted to follow up with him. But also, you know, a lot of these things actually took place in Kabul, so you can imagine sort of the extent to which some of these threats took place in the south and southeast, where there were gunfights in front of some female candidates' houses. We had one woman in Kandahar who said she left her province, went to live with relatives, and had been there for 3 weeks in the lead-up to the election, obviously not allowing her to campaign because of major threats that she had and men sort of coming around her house. With armed men coming around her house. So you can really see, I was struck by really how brave these women were. And after being in 50 countries, I actually think these were some of the bravest women that I've ever met in my life. Also, just briefly on the candidates, because women had limited access to public space, as they do in daily life in Afghanistan, you really saw women campaigning indoors. They talked about how they actually lit up when they talked about going door to door. They were really pleased with the receptivity they had when they went into friends' homes and families' homes. But the interesting thing is they were often really campaigning to women because it sounded like these gatherings were very much gatherings of women. And then you had women to a large degree disenfranchised. So I think it was interesting that that they were campaigning really just to women in large part. There was exception for some of the incumbents. They had access to some large gatherings. But in large part, we heard from the women that really, from the time that they get acceptance from their family to run, which is absolutely critical, they're really reliant on men for every aspect of their campaigns. Most of them really talked about how they got permission from elders and tribal leaders and religious leaders to run, and then you know, in very lucky cases, those men were able to, you know, provide opportunities for them to speak in mosques. But really, you saw it was the elders and the leaders who opened the door and asked people to open the door for women to go into people's homes to campaign, which was still really done in a private way. Across the world, you hear this, but in particularly in Afghanistan, the fundraising and the ability to have any sort of small money to campaign was really a challenge. And you saw women's posters, but a lot of times they were black and white instead of colored ones. And they, you know, women felt like they weren't able to compete on the same level as men because they weren't able to have this sort of visibility. And UNIFEM actually had a women's resource center, and they allowed for women to come in and print 1,000 posters for free of their campaign posters. And you saw that 36 women came from various provinces, traveled to Kabul just to print 1,000 posters to hang up in their districts. Just finally, we'll have the conclusions and recommendations in our final report, but I think, as you've already heard, many of the challenges that women faced really could have been addressed with more preparation, particularly the staffing in the polling stations and the security guards, which really was a sort of rushed effort at the very last minute to try to prepare for. We already included in our statement a recommendation for increased civic outreach to women and men on the issue of women's participation and the importance of everyone voting and the importance of the privacy of a vote. And finally, the ability to verify female voters without any sort of way of identifying women with a photo or whatever the case may be, if it's eye scan or something more sophisticated, you really have no way of verifying that a woman is who she says she is. So with that, I'll stop there.
Well, thank you, Kristen. Now over to you, Ambassador Enderford.
Thank you, Karen. I'm delighted to have a chance to be the final speaker so I can build on the points already made by my colleagues, my Kabul colleagues, I should add. We had a great experience observing this election. I'd like to step back and call attention to some larger points here and use that as our concluding comment before we go to questions and answers. I'd like to start with what Kristen had to say. Now, I'm looking at our report that we did. I trust that you have seen that, particularly the overview that we have and the recommendations. I want to start where she left off. We say in the report that the rights of women in the electoral process require special attention. I just want to underscore that. We had an opportunity to meet with three male and three female candidates for the provincial council in Kabul. We had a good discussion with them. The women that were there were extraordinary. They were the most animated and motivated and articulate. They clearly see the stakes in this election for them and what is important here. Kristen said when we were in Kabul that these were the bravest women that she has seen in covering many elections and seeing the role of women. I'd have to underscore that. The women there also know that if the darkness descends again on Afghanistan, they will pay the greatest price. So while we're looking at large issues of al-Qaeda and all of the security issues, we cannot forget fundamental principles and values at stake in what goes on there. Secondly, I do want to call attention to the reference in the report to the security situation. Obviously, violence and the threat of violence shaped this election. And we say in the report that it is critical for the growth and survival of the nation's incipient democratic process that the continuing insurgency is brought to an end. Obvious point, but it needs to be restated here, and we've all seen that General McChrystal has now forwarded his recommendations. This is a big issue, but we can't get Afghanistan right unless we get the security part of this right. I wanted to call attention to that. We've already heard from Peter and others about where the international community fell down in the run-up to this election. We heard from Grant Kippen, who is president of the ECC, saying that the international community took its eye off the ball after the 2005 election, for the next several years. A UNDP official called the years of 2006 through 2007-8 a funding graveyard in terms of the assistance that we were providing there. It did obviously pick up in the last year. We have a recommendation here about the international community in partnership with the Afghan government should immediately begin preparing for the next election cycle and not allow that funding graveyard to continue. The elections in 2010 for parliamentary elections, and then obviously the next round of the presidential elections 5 years later. This is all hopeful. We have to get through this current election before we can go on to the next, obviously. But we do need to not step away from the plate again in terms of funding. Now, a broader issue, I'd like just to mention this. We saw in the Washington Post today the editorial, setback in Afghanistan. I don't think any of us cannot say that this was a setback. Of course it was a setback. The security threats, the allegations of fraud, misconduct, and the rest. But I do think that we need to also step back for a moment and place this election in a broader context. If you look at where Afghanistan has been and where it is today and where we hope it goes, it's important. Afghanistan's road to self-government, if you will, it was 2001 when we started the U.S. bombing campaign in Afghanistan and routed the Taliban. We had the bond process in November of 2001, bringing together all of these groups there. An interim authority was established in December of 2001. In 2002, the emergency lawyer Jirga was convened to agree on a transitional authority. In 2003, the constitutional lawyer Jirga took place. 2004, a constitution was adopted. Also in 2004, President Karzai won the presidential election. In 2005, elections for the parliament. In December of 2005, the convening of the National Assembly. Now we have this election. Nobody's going to suggest that it was a major step forward in this democratic process, but it is a step, and we do need to place this in context. Democracy, self-government is not going to come overnight to Afghanistan. There will be setbacks along the way, and what we need to do in terms of the international community is to work with the Afghans to see they make it through this difficult time. I want to call attention to one final part of our report. The last paragraph in our overview section, I'd just like to read this to you as a concluding comment before we go to the discussion. It reads, "This election has demonstrated that millions of Afghans want to participate directly in the country's evolving democratic political system. The August 2009 elections were the latest step in Afghanistan's long road toward constructing a democratic political system. This delegation strongly believes that the international community must continue to assist them in this journey. A democratic and peaceful Afghanistan is in the interest of the Afghan people and the international community." So with that concluding comment, Karen.
Thank you very much. And I think everyone can see that this was an extraordinarily complex challenge, the observing as well as the participation that NDI and other groups did along with their Afghan counterparts. I'm noticing a lot of serious expertise in this room, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of questions. What I'd like to do is take about three or four questions at a time and then go back to the panel. So everyone here will take good notes. And please introduce yourself. Please try to keep your questions short so that we have time for many. So I've got Alex, then Rick, then Hardin. Alex, you're over there. Yeah.
Hey, is this on?
I don't know. No.
It's on.
No. Is it working? Oh, it is?
Thanks, guys. Fantastic panel and insights. Two quick
Alex,
questions.
Just introduce yourself. Sorry.
Sorry, I'm Alex Thier from the U.S. Institute of Peace. One somewhat more technical question and then a broader question. One of the innovations of this election was that the ballots were to be counted at the polling stations, as opposed to having them aggregated, and that can have good implications or bad implications. One of the disappointing things, I think, about the results that have come in so far, together with the work that NDI and others did to train and deploy candidate agents and other monitors, is that one of the things that we'd hoped for is that there would be counting that was observed at the polling stations and that those figures would then be posted at the polling stations, which would allow for some kind of parallel check on the process that of counting that the IEC was doing. That seems to have failed completely as far as I can tell, in the sense that from what I've heard from anecdotal accounts, the results haven't been reported. People were often not allowed to view the counts. And so I'm wondering if you could explain why that hasn't succeeded, or if we're not hearing about why that has been valuable, but the information hasn't come out. And the broader thing that I think Ken said, but I'm not sure, but really to all of you, I mean, I think that the only way out of this election crisis is a runoff. I think that the legitimacy is so tainted that any number that Karzai gets, 51, 52, 53%, is simply not going to be tolerated by the opposition or by the Afghan people. When you look on YouTube and see these fantastic videos of guys sitting there with the ballot books, checking vote after vote after vote, the level of evidence of fraud, to my mind, suggests that the only way you get out of this with a legitimate outcome is for a runoff. So if I'm right, or if that is what happens, what can we do in the next 6 weeks to deal with some of the problems? Can we actually do a better job of detecting the fraud, or threatening to detect the fraud in advance so that it'll be a fairer election? Is there something on security that could have done better? What can we do to avoid having a runoff that just gets us in the same place that we are right now?
Great, thanks. Rick? Get right here.
Thank you. It seems, Rick Barton from CSIS, it seems as if there's going to be the only institutional solution is if the Complaints Commission really works well. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on how it's working. Do they have the capacity to adjudicate 500 serious complaints? Have the most valuable complaints come from the campaigns as opposed to independent sources? Are the members of the commission safe, or do they have offshore homes already? There's just a whole series of how were they selected. There's an awful lot of weight that's falling upon a handful of individuals who have never probably had this kind of responsibility before in their lives inside of a system that isn't going to guarantee them their safety. So the insights into that commission would really be helpful. Thanks.
Rick, okay. On you. And just a comment about Hardin. He was in Kandahar with Democracy International.
Hi, my name is Hardin Lang. I'm here at the Center for Strategic International Studies. Ken, you made an excellent point about a number of delegations that deployed down and end up being sort of captured by the PRTs as we attempted to carry out long-term observation. In Kandahar, my particular delegation managed to set up an operation outside the wire, which allowed us to move around on polling day and at least observe inside of the city limits a bit of what was going on. And to me, the point of greatest concern in my mind at this point, we made our way to about maybe one-third of the polling centers in Kandahar City, where we saw turnout rates rather low compared to 2004. In fact, your average for your polling station stood at about 51 to 52. The IEC are now releasing results in Kandahar that show results of 200, and then today there were some of up to 400 per polling station in Kandahar. And I'm just sort of wondering how this information gets filtered up and at what point the level of credibility becomes very difficult to adjudicate and what mechanisms are in place to deal with that. And a second point to Christine, just sort of to play off of the point that you made about the preparations for security. We spoke to a number of, one, a presidential candidate, and then a couple of candidates for provincial council in Kandahar who said, frankly, that they were waiting to speak to their voters and supporters about turning out, not so much based on where the Afghan National Police were that day, but based on the disposition of forces of the Taliban the day before and what they had picked up. So that's what they were really concerned about, and that's what they called in to us to tell us whether or not it was safe to go out that day based on where the Taliban were. Thanks.
Right behind you, yeah.
Thank you very much. Jeff McCausland from Penn State University and the Carnegie Council. Again, terrific panel. Very short, very blunt question. I realize that you caveat report quite rightfully, since only 6% of the results have been returned. But the blunt question I have is, it the essence of the panel that there was a systematic attempt by President Karzai and or his supporters to basically rig this election? That seems to be the summary that I'm getting from all your comments in terms of precluding women from voting, how the security force were positioned, et cetera, et cetera. But is that really, at this state, the panel's conclusion based on 60% of return, that there was a systematic attempt to rig these elections by the ruling party?
And just one more in this round. There was a gentleman over there, please. Thank you.
John Rothenberg, independent consultant. This is sort of in addition to Alex's question. I think the only other solution is some kind of a negotiated deal between Karzai and Abdullah. Do you think that the people of Afghanistan would accept that, and what kind of format would that take?
Okay, great.
In your mind.
Thank you very much. Let's start. Maybe Rick, do you want to make a few comments, so we can just come down this way?
Well, first of all, this panel has not reached that conclusion that there was a systematic attempt by the ruling party and President Karzai to rig the election. I never said that. I didn't hear anyone say that. So that was not our conclusion at all. You'll need – it's a much more nuanced look at this election from what we saw and what we've been following since then. So that's not our conclusion. I'd like to respond to that question of the ruling coalition of President Karzai and Abdullah. However this ends up at the end of the day, I think that the most important thing is for the Afghans themselves to pull together. And that means a lot of people being able to work with their opponents. We all hear that the clock is ticking on terms of U.S. and international involvement, 12 months, 18 months. We see the papers, we see the polls, we see the statements being made in European capitals. For this to work, it is going to require the Afghans themselves to, if you will, reboot. They need themselves to say, how do we do what we can do and only we can do, which is governance, which is the corruption issue, which is tackling these internal problems. The international community can't do that. So whether it be some bridging of Abdullah and Karzai and Ashraf Ghani and all of this, they need to pull together. Because if they are divided, if there is weak civilian leadership, if there is divisiveness, we can't do this. So however they work it out, I hope they do as soon as this election period is resolved.
Kristen, did you want to? Okay.
Address two points. First, Alex, in regard to where the ballots were being counted, obviously that was a huge controversy. After the last election, then-candidate Kanuni had objected to the ballots being counted at the provincial level, thinking that was lent itself to greater abuse. I think in retrospect, that the ballots probably should have been counted at the provincial level. There's still a couple of checks on the system, but whether they'll work or not remains to be seen. At the polling station level, everybody has to, all the observers that are there, if there are any, and the political party agents have to sign off on the final tally, which is then supposed to be posted. If, in fact, on review, if the IEC or the ECC finds that the party agents haven't signed off on the tally that's being reported, then that could trigger additional scrutiny, and presumably those votes would be quarantined. We'll have to see whether that process actually works. In regard to the ECC, there was a question about security. It was kind of interesting because I actually asked Grant Kippen that question, and he said that he had been provided an armored vehicle and a personal security detail, as were the other international members. There are five members, three of whom are international, two are Afghan. The three international ones are appointed by the Secretary General of the UN, the special representative of the Security General. The other two are Afghans. One comes from the Human Rights – one's appointed by the Human Rights Commission, one by the Afghanistan Supreme Court. The Afghan members weren't provided any security for some reason. He was quite concerned about it because he thought there was a real security threat. The ECC has a staff of 200 people. They got their funding quite late in the process. When I arrived for the election in Afghanistan, just a couple weeks before the election, they were still doing their last training of their provincial staff. He was very critical of the funding agencies in regard to the movement of money to support the ECC process. Nevertheless, I think that they're doing a good job. They face an enormous challenge. They have 2,000 complaints. I think they've already thrown out about 1,000 of them, but they still have 500 that they consider to be very serious. Whether they could process those by September 17th when the election is supposed to be certified remains to be seen. I mean, I think they're working very hard, and they're doing what they can.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would just say one thing to add to that. Grant Kippen, who is the chairman, used to be NDI's director in Afghanistan for a number of years, and so he knows the environment. He's deeply committed to this process. And I think that they take a position, I think it's in the electoral law, that the IEC, the Electoral Commission, is unable to certify the elections until the ECC completes its work. And I think that he raised the possibility, Grant did yesterday, in their press conference, that they may not complete their work by September 17th. So I think they're driven by the process, not driven by dates. And I think that is reassuring. There are a lot of, I think, safeguards built in. Some of the safeguards, by the way, in the software in the IEC is not known, because they want to keep some of those safeguards secret. So there could be some people that could figure out ways to hack the system. And I think also that there are provisions within the ECC to enable them to carry on their work, and they have investigators that they are sending out, and that process has already begun. So it's not just them sitting in a room looking at issues. They are actually sending people out to certain places. With regard to this notion of a deal, this is, we saw the issues in Kenya. We saw these issues that have been raised in Zimbabwe, where in the end the notion of a power-sharing agreement was the last best hope to avoid bloodshed. I think it is way too early to talk about those issues now. I think that the Afghan people went to the polls wanting a process that was going to reflect their will. And if you look at every poll that's been conducted in the country, this was not an artificial process. This is a process, I think, that represented the hopes and aspirations of the Afghan people. And if people now talk about this, some type of power-sharing agreement, as a substitute to a legitimate election process, I think that the repercussions, both short-term but long-term, I think would be quite damaging. I think first we have to deal with the issue of the integrity of the election process, and that's where much falls on the shoulders of the IEC and the ECC. And second, we have to talk about the legitimacy of the institutions that emerge. And again, I will say it is not only the issue of the president, it's also the issue of 34 provincial councils around the country as well. And those are the institutions that the Afghans will – this is not a spectator sport at that level. These are individuals and institutions that the Afghans will have to interact with over the course of the next 4 or 5 years. On the Kandahar that Hardin raised, I don't know. I don't know what the ICC has quarantined in Kandahar. I don't know what the ECC is looking at right now in Kandahar. I know they sent a team down to investigate Kandahar. In particular, reports have been coming out of Kandahar about problems. So these, conceivably, the numbers that we're seeing could change, depending on what the IEC does and what the ECC does. So you know, I think there are going to be a number of places where we're going to see some numbers, and then the question, then the responsibility falls with these two institutions. Finally, on Alex raised the issue about a parallel vote tabulation and the posting of, I think lots of people would have wanted to see a system where FIFA, the domestic monitoring organization, could have carried out a parallel vote tabulation nationwide. I think it would have been extremely difficult under the circumstances. Now, unlike the international observers, FIFA said they were in all 34 provinces, but they were hampered by the security situation as well. When we trained the candidate agents, we insisted on two things. The first was that they would be literate, and the second that they would have already been accredited by the Electoral Commission to be candidate agents. And what this did was it spurred the candidates to register their agents before the training began. And so what we tried to do is help create a critical mass of party agents. But I think it would have been very, very difficult for party agents to be in all the places because of that security challenge. And I imagine it still would have been difficult for any organization to develop a wide enough sample and a statistically random sample, significant sample, to develop a parallel vote tabulation. I think it's unfortunate, and I hope that in future elections, that will be a component. And now that the votes are being counted at the polling site level, there is at least the possibility of doing some verification that will be seen as being an accurate reflection of what happened in the voting.
And just to add an additional point of pressure on the ECC and the IEC is to try to complete their work in time, that if there is a runoff, it happens before winter sets in. Because, of course, as we all know, there are more donkeys and mules transporting ballots than vehicles, and it would be too difficult to do it once winter sets in. So they really have a lot of pressure to finish this early on. Chris, did you want to have any?
Yeah, just two points. Going back to Hardin's point about it's not so important where the police and ANA is array, but rather where the Taliban are. That's actually the opposite. They're two sides of the same coin. The Taliban are where there are no government security forces. So, you know, at the end of the day, we've known this election was coming around for a while. And the fact that police production has been such a challenge for the international community, I think it's really inexcusable. And you don't have to have 100 Talibs arrayed with RPGs. You actually just need one guy standing outside a polling center. He doesn't even have to have arms, but everyone knows who he is and what he's going to be doing. So, you know, this just goes back to the larger point that this should have been a priority. Police training is absolutely fundamental. By the way, armies don't win insurgencies. Police win insurgencies. So there are multiple reasons why the oversight of the police is absolutely egregious. And I also want to go back to the point that Alex made about a runoff. You know, I'm not an election person by profession. You know, I really look at internal security issues. One of my biggest concerns about a Karzai victory sans a runoff is that this comes back to the issue of governance and credibility. And again, when we think about yes, a runoff may be expensive. It may be tactically and very difficult to do, particularly with weather. It may be violent. But the long-term consequences of not having a runoff and not having a president, which is seen to be credible, will have much more significant long-term consequences in terms of trying to deal with the insurgency. And this came out in some of the comments that McChrystal said. This is not just about security. This is about governance. So if we don't have in there a president that's seen as credible, being able to resolve this insurgency in any fashion, be it negotiations with the Taliban, be it try to provide government services, it's just going to be really difficult if you don't have a guy in Kabul that seemed to be legitimate.
Okay, let's do a second round. I saw Ed, then Shuja. Okay, thanks, Chris. See you later. And then this gentleman here, you also. Okay.
Thank you, Karen. Edward Joseph, Helsinki Commission. Let me first congratulate NDI for great work out there, not only on this observation, but Ken as well, on training polling agents and also the domestic monitors. That's to be commended. And let me, if I could, take another run at Alex's question. about a potential second round, because I think it's quite important. I believe Ambassador Inderfirth mentioned that your views are, or the views of your team are somewhat nuanced, but the narrative certainly is not nuanced. The narrative would to be something like it was a sham. Now, I understand that there were positive things about the campaigning and discussion of issues and so forth, but the question of the second round goes to this overarching issue, which is inescapable, about the legitimacy, the perception of Afghans themselves as whether this is legitimate or not. And then Alex asked a very important question, which is, can anything be done in the limited time that would be there until the second round to make sure, if there is a second round, that it is better and more legitimate in the eyes of the Afghans than the first round? I think that's quite important, because some people think the answer is no, and they think that a second round will just give the Taliban another shot, and you'll end up with the same mess. So it's quite a dilemma, an important question. Very briefly, in terms of context, there is also a larger context not mentioned here, and that is that Afghanistan's neighbor, Iran, also had elections this summer that are quite disputed. And so the notion of legitimacy has a larger context. Does the panel believe that if we simply say, well, it was a step, you know, you can't expect too much, does that constrain what we might be able to say about the challenges raised about the Iranian election? Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Ken.
Ed, let me just, you know, I don't think it's our place to say that there should be a second round. I mean, before the IEC and the EC completes its work, I think that would be rather premature for us to say this is what was the result of the election. There is no doubt, however, when one looks at it politically, that should there be a second round, the problems that existed in the first round would take on less significance. And you will have people that will look at it and say, despite all of these flaws and all of these problems, the system worked in the sense that there is another shot at this. So politically, I think, from even the notion of a perception issue, it is no doubt, you look at our own election here, when elections are very, very close and you have a winner and there have been significant irregularities, those irregularities take on added significance in those types of close elections. And so a second round allows those issues to be addressed. In terms of what happens in a second round, let me just say some issues are out of everybody's hands. The question is what the Taliban is going to do in certain areas. But I think in terms of what ISAF does and what the Afghan police and the military do, I think there could be beefed up security, perhaps to expand areas that are less secure. And I think that there's going to have to be a concerted effort on the part of all three to see if there is going to be a greater presence to expand the areas of security. And so that is one thing that can be done. The other issue in terms of irregularities, misconduct, fraud, those are issues of political will. And those are the issues that the candidates themselves are going to have to impose on their supporters around the country. And what pressure can be brought to bear to ensure that there is that political will, it's a short period of time. And the question is, that falls on the leadership of these movements to be able to impose some discipline on their supporters to ensure that some of the more egregious problems that we all saw and are emerging right now are not repeated in a second round.
Okay, let's try to take the question. So, Shuja, over here, please. Oh, there's a microphone. Yep, I see you. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get everybody. I see you, too.
Thank you. I'm Shuja Nawaz from the Atlantic Council. I have two related questions. One is about the relationship between the levels of violence in the provinces preceding the elections. There's an excellent Wall Street Journal map that showed that this was largely in the sort of Pakhtun belt. Are you going to be able to analyze and help us understand what that effect had on voting patterns in those provinces? And related question is, in Kunar and Nuristan, according to that map, there was relatively less violence or almost none. What did you hear, if anything, about the role of Hikmatyar in all of this? Was there some kind of a secret deal made with Mr. Karzai that may have accounted for this, or was this something that was unexpected?
Okay, great. Can I have the gentleman in the back? He's been waiting patiently. Yeah. Thank you. Was there? Yeah.
Thank you. Fred Tipson with the UN Development Program here in Washington. Can we unpack this notion of the international community a little bit and get to the question as to how the UN itself performed in supporting these elections, UNDP in particular? I think it's helpful to kind of break down the notion of international community support.
Thanks. I'd like to thank the panel, distinguished panel, for excellent insights. My name is Steve Gale. I'm on the House Subcommittee on Foreign Security, Foreign Affairs and National Security. And I guess I have two questions that span a number of issues. But one is, you've talked about the shortcomings in training, shortcomings in the police, shortcomings in security, and a number of issues which I think you've done an excellent job in highlighting. So my two questions are this. One, given all these shortcomings, who do you see as the real winner in this election process in terms of institutions? And secondly, what does this say about the U.S. engagements in the last 5 years? And I would guess about $37 billion have been spent in Afghanistan. What does this say about the actual process in terms of supporting elections? And I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you. Kumar from Amnesty International. I have two quick questions. First is about the Independent Election Commission. Now, there were concerns that it's not independent at all. The members were handpicked. What's your observation about that and how it affects the credibility of the results? Second is about the media. There were some journalists who were investigating corruption of the administration, were harassed and abused. How is that played into independence of elections? Thanks.
Al Milliken, AM Media. Are there any other nations or international organizations you would single out positively or negatively for the role they have played in the 2009 elections and any contributions that stood out in a special way from your observation?
Ken, why don't you start? You can tackle.
Well, in terms of the IEC, our statement refers to the independence or and perceived lack of independence of the IEC. There was no doubt that there were some controversial statements made by the IEC early on. There were also decisions that were made by the IEC that demonstrated an independence from the government. However, we said in the statement that if an organization is going to be call itself independent and be seen as independent, there has to be a structure that ensures that independence and autonomy. And so we recommended that they go back to the drawing boards and provide some checks on an election commission that is appointed by the president. Legislation has been passed to that effect, but President Karzai has not signed it. And so we recommended for future elections that there will be a different system for choosing and confirming members of the election commission. I think in terms of organizations and groups that performed well, I don't think I'm in a position, and Fred, to begin. We had enough of a challenge looking at this election process to spend time sort of analyzing and grading international actors and what they did and what they didn't do, I think would be very difficult. I think everyone, as Peter said, were performing in the 11th hour. And I think that was very difficult.
AID got good
and I was just going to say AID, however, seemed to have a more sustained presence during that period between 2005 and 2009. And I should add that USAID had supported this observation mission. A lot of other groups, because of that quote-unquote funding graveyard, had a very, very difficult time ramping up in the 11th hour. And I think that's a lesson that is to be learned from all of this. In terms of the media, there is, I think, from the observation and all the studies that were done, that the private media was relatively fair and balanced in the process. But there was no doubt that the Media Commission issued report after report highlighting the bias in state-run media. And it was unfortunate, and we talked about this in our statement, that actions were not taken by the IEC to impose sanctions on the media, to force the media, the state-run media, to abide by the media code of conduct that was passed by the ECC and the ICC, which should have been done and should be done in the future. In terms of the violence, we are going to be doing some mapping for our final report and look at areas of violence, but there is also an element in this, too, that affected the campaign. Peter is right. The campaign surprised lots of people because it focused on issues. 10 million people watched the debates. Candidates crossed ethnic lines to campaign. There was very little inter-ethnic violence that took place. The presidential candidates were able to operate. Even, again, the silver lining in the story that appeared in the Post yesterday, that you had in a Pashtun area, Dr. Abdullah working out a deal with a Pashtun tribe for its support. So you did have this notion of what appeared to be people willing to cross ethnic lines to vote in this election. But there was also the threat of violence, and not only the violence that had an impact. In Kunduz, for example, the Kunduz province, radio stations were begging candidates and women candidates to appear on radio, and yet they wouldn't appear on radio. So the campaign in those areas where there was the greatest threat of violence, during the campaign period, people would rather campaign in their homes and not in a very visible way. And so a lot of the media, a lot of the visible campaigning just didn't take place, and it affected the campaign environment. Yet there was very active campaigning that was taking place in these homes. I think those were some of the main okay. issues.
Kristen, do you want to make some last comments?
I'll just briefly mention one positive thing that I thought UNDP had done was play a role in establishing a gender unit within the IEC. Now, that gender unit was set up very late due to a variety of constraints. IFAS also played a role in helping to staff and support the Afghans working in the IEC. But there was one woman seconded by UNDP who actually sat within the IEC. And I thought this was actually, I think looking at a potential runoff, we may not be able to adequately address many of the challenges that women face, but I do see this gender unit as an opportunity going forward to really focus on the civic education that's required. And they did play a role in making sure that information was gender disaggregated and, we're definitely a voice and I think will be a stronger voice going forward. So,
okay.
Just one additional piece of information about Fred's question about UNDP and the United Nations. I mean, do keep in mind that this election was Afghan-run. It was their decision. They wanted to move to have responsibility for the election after 2004-2005 when the UN was the primary agent. Not only did they want to have responsibility for the electoral process, but they also, in terms of the security provided, they continually talked about the three rings of security on election day. First, the Afghan police, then the ANA, the army, and then ISAF would be there if needed. So in terms of that road to self-government that I mentioned, this plays into that. However, there was a funding graveyard, which we heard from UN officials, that took place in 2005, 6, and 7. 2008, I think UNDP got about $130 million to start that voter registration process. 2009, I think $250,000, $225 million UNDP had. They've set aside, I think we heard, about $20 million for the runoff, or they've set aside some of that funding if needed for a runoff, but clearly more will be needed. And the real issue here is the sustainability of the electoral process for Afghanistan over the long term. They cannot pay for these things. They do not have the funding, the budget to do that. So in terms of the international commitment, we do need to get a fast start on what occurs next after this period is resolved, hopefully successfully and legitimately and credibly. But we do need to be looking at the electoral mechanisms as well as the sustainability of funding for these down the road.
One concluding comment. I think what we've seen over the past 5 or 6 years is the international community having very low expectations about what could be accomplished in Afghanistan, and perhaps much lower than the Afghans themselves. When we would ask people why didn't you prepare better for the 2009 elections, we were told by some donors that we weren't even sure the elections would really take place. They didn't want to put money into a process that they thought would not even occur. Although I don't think the Afghans had any doubt that the elections would take place. But, you know, it's the legacy of the soft footprint that Mr. Brahimi first talked about back in 2002. I think that's really formed a sort of a mental framework for the international community in approaching Afghanistan, and I think it's been much to the detriment of the country.
Right. Great. Thank you, Peter. I'd just also like, before closing, to thank my colleague Justine Fleischner over in the corner there, who really put this all together, and the other volunteers for helping us out today. Thanks to our very extraordinary panel. Mailing list and wants to hear about future events, our project will continue to work on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Please sign up outside the door. So thank you again for coming.